When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, this is the Fiction Nonfiction Podcast from Literary Hub, where we believe that every issue in your social media feed or on the evening news has already been tackled somewhere in literature. I'm Whitney Terrell, author of the novel The Good Lieutenant.
And I'm Vivi Ganeshanathan, also known as Sugi, author of the novel Brotherless Night.
You ever heard me mention the term racial covenant, Sugi?
Only about 100 times. But I think actually mostly, as I recall, you talked about it in our double episode with Jess Rowe and Timothy Yu titled On Whiteness and Writing About Race.
We did a double episode.
That is seems
like
to me
very 70s of us.
That is very strange. It's like a double album. And those two episodes were all the way back August 22nd and August 29th of 2019, when the show was young. And we'll post links to those in our show notes so that listeners can check them out. I thought those were really good episodes because they thought about the idea of whiteness and what whiteness meant, rather than kind of assuming that whiteness itself was some sort of norm or default.
Yeah, exactly. And today we're going to continue that discussion with an author whose new book tries to put a value in monetary terms, in social terms, in emotional terms on being white. For instance, what is it worth to be a white person in a white neighborhood protected by a racial covenant that prevents non-white people from living there?
That's a fascinating question. And to answer it and many more, we are pleased to welcome my friend Tracy McMillan. She's the author of the New York Times bestseller, The American Way of Eating, which won the Books for a Better Life Award and the Hillman Prize for Book Journalism. Tracy served as a senior fellow at the Schuster Institute for Investigative Journalism, the managing editor at City Limits Magazine in New York City, and as a member of the James Beard Foundation Media Awards Journalism Committee, where she pushed for broader racial, economic, and geographic diversity in judging panels. She's presently an editor at Capital and Maine. Her new book, which she's here to talk about, is The White Bonus: Five Families and the Cash Value of Racism in America. Tracy, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. In the introduction to The White Bonus, you write, "I thought race and racism only happened to people who were not white." I think this is a pretty common thought among white people that I know when they're thinking about race at all. Can you talk about where that concept comes from and why, as you demonstrate, it's not true?
Yeah, you know, I always think about this in terms of color blindness. You know, I think, you know, my parents definitely raised me to think of myself as colorblind, that the way to be, you know, a good person out in the world was just to not to see race. And, you know, then there are scholars, right, that have really been interrogating that for a long time. The one I'm most familiar with is Eduardo Bonilla Silva, right, who writes about colorblind racism and how colorblindness, this concept, can actually end up supporting sort of racist stuff out in the world. And so for me, it just felt really important, you know, to start looking at myself as somebody who is white in a world where, you know, we talk about black and white and things like that. But, you know, I knew things, I sort of got things for being white, and I didn't understand what they were. And so the idea for me was to sort of dig into that.
So in the book, you define three areas that compose what you call the white bonus. And I wonder if you could just talk through those three things for our listeners and talk a little bit about the title of the book itself, how you came up with that term, and maybe how it relates to a term that they might be maybe a little more familiar with, the term white privilege.
Sure. So, you know, the white bonus concept, right, this is a rough back of the envelope estimate. This is not a social science measure, right? I think a lot of folks get a little anxious when I say, well, we could quantify this, and people go, no, you couldn't. I say, well, we need to start talking about this, right? And so this estimate is money that an individual white person probably got or saved because they were white, right? And so that's sort of digging into both stuff that comes down through your family, right? And whether or not they would have had that money if they weren't white, as well as, you know, sort of money that you might get because you're hired for a job, because you're given a cheaper apartment, things like that, because you're white, right? And so it's just this idea of turning the lens on white advantage and putting a number to it so that we can actually talk about it, right? Because when you're talking about white privilege, you know, it's a really amorphous sort of, I think of it almost as like a phantom out in the ether, and you try and grab onto it and that shape shifts and changes and moves out of reach, right? And so the thing that is useful about the white bonus is it's a material measure. And so you stop arguing about whether or not it exists, and you start arguing about sort of what it, how it works and like what it's doing. And I think that can be a helpful approach.
I mean, one of the things that you write about that I've written about in the past as well is the idea of colorblindness. Like, segregation occurs because that's just market forces acting on the way that people live, right? And of course, that's not true, you know, and you talk a lot about housing policy in the book and racial covenants, which were a big deal in Kansas City. And you write, in 1924, the National Association of Real Estate Boards, a private confederation of real estate brokers from across the country, instructed its members that an ethical realtor, quote, should never be instrumental in introducing into a neighborhood a character of property or occupancy, members of any race or nationality, or any individuals whose presence will clearly be detrimental to property values in that neighborhood, which generally means black people. J.C. Nichols, whose housing policies were crucial to my novel, The King of Kings County, was a proponent of racial covenants, rotated through the presidency of this National Association of Real Estate Boards during this time. I'm sure it had something to do with that policy. I've written about the emotional and social cost of the policies, but the economic cost, you know, can you talk about that and how you ended up quantifying it for yourself?
Yeah, so the way that I deal with racial covenants and those sorts of housing policies is I'm not actually looking at the dollar value to like my great-grandfather or my grandfather who had racial covenants on their homes, right? For me, right, the way that this white bonus thing is working is I sort of look at myself and I say, well, how much money has my family spent on me since I left home, right? That's extra money they had. They didn't have to spend it, right? They no longer have any legal obligation to me. And where did it come from? How did we get it, right? And when I started peeling back the layers of my family and sort of running back the tape, kind of, you know, it just became really clear that, you know, neither of my grandparents would have had inheritable wealth to send down to their kids and then on to me if they hadn't had racial covenants on their homes, right? Because we talk so often about racial covenants as banning, you know, primarily black families from living in certain areas, although, you know, depending on the covenant, right, sometimes it was much more exclusive of other groups, or would just sort of say, you have to be Caucasian to live here, right? So if you couldn't be Caucasian, that was just like, everybody else doesn't get to invest in their home in this place that we as a society have deemed valuable, right? Because I think so often, you know, I think of this as a big sort of white middle class cultural thing, right? We say, oh, well, but if it's a market force, like we can't do anything about it. It, like, if it has a racist effect, it's just the market. But, you know, markets are things that we actually put values into and decide, like, who gets to profit from it, right? Like, who is going to get sort of that market value. And in the US, right, we largely, certainly in the 20th century, restricted that mostly to white people.
I think of a specific example of that, like my parents' house they bought in a neighborhood that wasn't legally covenanted, because those were kind of struck, they were declared unenforceable by the Supreme Court in like 45, but they were still, for all intents and purposes, you know, the tradition of it being a white-only neighborhood was what that neighborhood was. And so they bought a house for $60,000 in like 67, and it's worth $1 million now, maybe, I don't know. And if you look at, I lived in a neighborhood that was not covenanted, that was mostly black for the first 10 years that I lived in Kansas City when I moved back. And my neighbor, like Helen Palmer, owned her house, and her house was worth 50, I don't know, 75. And she'd owned it for as long as my parents, or at least a comparable amount of time. Like, she just never saw the housing price increases that people in white neighborhoods did.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like for me, right, when I went into working on the white bonus, I was sort of like, I'm going to find all these like obscure, weird ways that discrimination happens and has a material value. And then, I mean, the things that I think are the most broad and consistent, you know, because I study five different families, including my own, right? The thing that's most broad and consistent is stuff like housing discrimination, not necessarily covenants, right? But discrimination between realtors and sellers and buyers, right? Like that kind of stuff. Or you know, wage discrimination, right? Occupational segregation. Those are things that I saw appear again and again in every single story that I was telling, right? And, you know, I had been like, and that stuff is more at the interpersonal level and sort of implicit bias level. And that's sort of why, like, when I'm calculating a white bonus, right? You know, for me as like a lower middle class type person, you know, I got like, you know, my estimate is $146,000 inflation adjusted from my family, but like almost $250,000 of sort of savings and wages and equity, right, from the implicit bias that sort of helped me along in my adulthood.
Okay, we're going to take a short break here and we'll be right back.
So you're talking, of course, a lot about yourself and about your own, your family's history, and you're a journalist, you know, an investigative journalist with, in some sense, very traditional chops of that profession. And unlike creative writers, many journalists are taught to report on other people and leave themselves out of it. And you have in this book and also actually in your earlier book, you write about yourself, too. And you write about your grandparents' housing choices, their military service, your parents' first home, and your own experiences going to NYU and becoming a journalist in New York. These are just a few things in the book. And some of this material, particularly your relationship with your father, which comes up over the course of the book, some of that's very charged. So I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about the choice to include that material and to write about it.
Yeah, I mean, it was a bit of a, how do I say this? It was a bit of a struggle for me to write well about myself. You know, I think I had gotten really used to sort of being able to go into elite journalism cocktail parties and sort of talk self-deprecatingly about myself, right? It's something that certainly like 10, 15 years ago when I was sort of first really getting into my career, like that was very helpful, right? Sort of ingratiate myself with, you know, like older white men by being this sort of like punchy, like young woman, and I could do all these things. And I found when I started trying to write about myself in that voice, that was unpleasant. I sound like a total jerk, right? It was horrible. And like, I was just like, I don't think I want to hang out with me. And if I want my readers to, maybe I should think about that. Because also, right, that's a self-protective defense mechanism, right? So that I was never bringing up the things that were actually hard about my life, right? I would sort of make reference to, you know, oh, well, I don't have a silver spoon in my mouth. My parents didn't pay for college, right? But the truth, right, is that I grew up in a household where, you know, my mother was dying over the course of 9 years because we didn't have health care for her. And my father was becoming increasingly abusive, right? And so that's not something you want to bring up at the cocktail party, right? And so learning to write about that, I thought that was just an interesting project. I will also say that for me, it just became very clear that the experiences I had had of being like a powerless kid caring for her parent, of being a powerless teenager, right, living with an abusive dad, that nobody was checking, right? There were adults around me that knew this was happening, multiple adults, right? And just nobody did anything about it. You know, that's the stuff that for me comes up when I hear people of color talking about what it's like to deal with white people and racism, right? And so it's not the same system by any means, right? But for me, right, there's that echo and then getting to a point where I can be like, okay, well, maybe there's a way to use the fact that that infrastructure of abuse is the same, even when the scale and scope is different. Because honestly, I think the kind of abuse that I grew up with, you know, is extremely common, right? It wasn't daily. It probably is true that I was better off staying in my parents' home than being put into foster care, right? And so, you know, that's something that a lot of white people, particularly because of deference to white middle-class families, right? Like if you are a black family, you're much more likely to get policed for your parenting, right, than if you're a white family. But that also means that white kids who get treated poorly learn that you're just supposed to suck it up and be quiet and endure and get past it, right? So I think there's this thing where, like, for me, I wanted to break out of that pattern and sort of look at how do I use my personal story to walk readers with me through this, like, empathy and rigor that I have, and then sort of see where we can go from there.
It's interesting to hear you talk about this arc because I feel like 90% sure that you and I met at a cocktail party like that. For our listeners, Tracy and I overlapped at the University of Michigan, where she was a Knight Wallace Fellow, and I was then teaching in the MFA program. And most of my interactions with journalists during that time, which were very important to me, were through the Knight Wallace program, where I got to make a lot of friends. But it's often, like a sphere in which, conversation skates across a particular surface, or it can.
Yeah. I mean, I found it, you know, and I tried to figure out if I wanted to write about actually my experience at Michigan, because that was the first time that I was in these sort of very elite journalism circles. And, you know, and this was back in 2012, 2013. And I just remember being like, well, some of this feels really terrible. But I'm here to get paid and like get out. I mean, I'd been on food stamps like the year before, right? So I was just like, I'm here to get paid and figure out if I can survive in this. And I just took it all on as like, this is just what you have to do if you're going to like have this career. And, you know, at the further I got out from that and the more stable I got in my career, the more I was just like, that was not my vibe, right? Like, I'm grateful so much for all the things I got from that and the people I met. And I met some wonderful and amazing people there. But the culture of that stuff for me can be really off-putting.
Congratulations on making it through NYU without a lot of parental support. I have a son who's at NYU right now. Believe you me, he's getting his white bonus check from his mother and I on a semesterly basis. But, you know, it's not like, as you were saying, you know, you talked about your family being on the line, but you thought of thinking of your family as on the line between working class and middle class. It's a little more complicated than that. Your grandparents on, I think, your dad's side did end up having money, as you found out later. But, you know, it's not like you're a Rockefeller, right? And you could have framed this book. A different book, would have been like a story of your individual, independent efforts to climb up into the struggle out of an abusive relationship and into the educated professional class. I mean, you could have done a J.D. Vance with this thing, right? And then run for Senate. But instead, even despite the difficulties in your life, you chose to focus on the advantages that you had despite these difficulties. I wonder if you could talk about that choice.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to focus on the advantages I had gotten because I didn't know how to talk about them, right? Because there's so much pressure. And certainly for like being like a white woman with the kind of background that I have, to write about that and just to lean into this narrative that we all think we already know. And, you know, the problem with not acknowledging the bonus that trickles down at lower levels, right, means we never see it, right? Like when we say, well, if you're like a low-income white person, there's no white bonus to you, so stop worrying about it, right? It hides it from everybody, right? You know, when I think about sort of resentment in white communities, right, that gets racialized, right? So we talk about this in an election year a lot, you know, I think part of what's going on is that white people are never taught that we get stuff special, right? I did an interview with someone who was like, well, but like white people just have what all Americans are supposed to have. and I'm like, well, yes, but in practice, right, we have restricted it to white people. So I like that ideal, but that's not what we do. And my job as a journalist is to talk about what's actually happening on the ground, right? And so if you are raised in this country as a white person and nobody ever says to you, yeah, we gave your parents housing for free, right, or a really cheap mortgage. Like, yeah, like when it was all white people in college, it was free, right? We never say that. And so then how would you know, right? You've just been told your whole life to be colorblind and that you didn't get anything special. And then, so nobody ever tells you you're getting it special. And then you see people of color being talked about with empathy because they need some help, right? But you think you didn't get any help because we never said like that was happening. So to me, it just gets kind of like a little wild there.
I wonder if we could just real quickly go through, we talked about racial covenants earlier. You have a lot of specifics in the book about examples of the way that this works, right? And maybe we could just, I marked down some. You talk about the FHA loan process. You even at one point, shockingly, I think it's your grandmother sort of describes the atomic bomb as being kind of a bonus because it like saved your grandfather's life at the expense of many other people's lives, but they were not white people. So you talk about the GI Bill and the gatekeeping with who got funding for that to go to college. I wonder if you could just go through some of the examples of this the way that people in your family and the other characters in the book receive these bonuses.
Yeah, so the stuff that comes down from family largely was stuff like employment discrimination benefiting your parents and grandparents. Because, remember, it was legal until the 60s to discriminate, like, for employment, right? So I have a construction worker dad for someone who's got his job through his father-in-law who got into the union before it was integrated, right? So that, even though that's like a pretty hard scrabble income, it's what that family described as stabilizing them because he got into the union, right? And that's because he had ties to this guy, and the guy he had ties to got the job because he was white, right? Like that sort of thing. Credit discrimination, right? So people, like white people just being given more credit and more sort of generous terms of credit, right? You see that show up with mortgage lending often. That stuff still happens a lot, right? Even though it's illegal. Criminal justice, right? I talk, not just about like white bonus, but deference to white people and particularly to white families and to white middle class and above men, right? So I have, a character who decided in 1994 it would be a good idea to go deal LSD at school, right? So he gets caught. He threatens the snitch, so he ends up with also extortion and larceny charges. In 1994, right, so this is the height of punitive drug laws in a tough-on-crime district, and he gets given a second chance, right? Well, how did he get that second chance? So, A, there's deference to him and his family in giving him the second chance, but also his dad was an engineer. How did his dad become an engineer? Well, he studied when he was in Buffalo working at Kodak because Kodak paid for his tuition. Kodak has decades-long history of employment discrimination from the 60s through at least the 2010s, or 2000s, I think, right? So just sort of looking at how that stuff snowballs and then trickles down. So for me, it's all these like little things that just keep adding up, and then by the time it gets to like Gen X and beyond, right, like stuff is really built up.
Okay, we're going to take a short break here, and we'll be right back.
And you phrase that in the book, really helpfully, as like a direct payment and then compounding interest, which helped me to kind of understand the way you were talking about it. And for our listeners, kind of at the back of the book, there's some calculations there that pertain to the characters and some examples, things like the financial benefit of avoiding incarceration or foster care, et cetera, et cetera. And you chose particular families and characters to write about. You had to get their consent, obviously, to do that. And that sounds like a complex set of questions to be asking. I remember in college, I wrote a story about self-segregation, and I went looking for, I was a Harvard undergraduate, I went looking for an all-white blocking group, and I knew one. And I asked them if they would talk to me, and they were like, absolutely not. And I just was thinking about, what it took for your interviewees.
An all-white what kind of group did you
all-white,
say?
So like a housing group. At Harvard it's called a blocking group, and so it's like a group of students who choose to live in.
We had some Harvard speak there that I wanted to surface.
Sorry, thank you for surfacing the Harvard speak. Right, like it's a group of students who choose to live in the same residential college, not necessarily the same room, but the same residential college. And so I went looking. There were tons of all white blocking groups. And I knew one in my residential college, and I couldn't, and I was friends with a couple of them, and they were like, definitely not. They did not want it. They didn't want it recorded. And so just to think about, how do you get people to talk about this kind of very personal stuff? And the characters that you chose, the people that you chose to focus on, really defy stereotypes. They're not Karens, to use another white privilege, like internet standard term. And
Mimi, it's a Mimi term.
And so could you talk a little bit about the specific people that you profile in these sections, how you found them, how you developed those relationships?
Sure. So I'll just go through like chronologically, right? So I'm in the book chapter. So chapter two is Katrina Rechtemald, who is a union nurse with SEIU in Pittsburgh. So she grew up in like a white working class poor community. This is the daughter of the construction worker. Right. And so I found her ultimately through her union. right? I had initially thought I was going to go out and find like a restaurant worker, and I could not get anyone to talk to me. I mean, I spent like 6 weeks in Pittsburgh, and I was just like, I do not have time to spend more casting time. So I was like, I'll go through a group. And SEIU does really interesting sort of racial consciousness education with their members. And so they were on board to have me do that work. And then, you know, really they connected me with Katrina and they just let me go, right? There wasn't any handling or any of that stuff because this isn't about their campaigns or anything. And then all the rest of it that showed up, all I knew was Katrina was like a white nurse in Pittsburgh, which is a majority white city, which is unusual in this country. And that she kind of was like thinking more about race, right? And so all the other stuff that fleshes out her character just happened to be her life, right? Like it's just like it just happens that her best friend is also a nurse and is Black and had a very different path into nursing than Katrina did. It just so happens that Katrina's dad worked in the construction trades, which just so happened to be the site of a massive like integration protest in the 70s, right, around integrating the construction trades. So all that stuff gets brought in and lets me talk about race and labor in a way that I thought was really interesting and fun for me to sort of do. After that, I introduced readers to two sisters, millennials, who went through the public schools in Hattiesburg, Mississippi, because I wanted to study the resegregation of public schools. And I mean, that was very much like, I just found a white woman who was like, yes, I will talk to you about this. And I bet my family would also. I call them the Beckers in the book. I had to change their names, right? Which is not my preference, but I was willing to make that compromise in order to sort of tell that story. And I thought they were really interesting because you see both, you know, how white advantage was helping those girls and was helping them navigate what was increasingly a failing school district when they were going through it, right? It's recovered now. But also how, as that district fails, right, it starts failing them, right? Because they don't quite have enough resources to make up for the things that the school lacks, right? And so you have one girl who ends up not being able to finish college because she hadn't been educated enough in high school to succeed in college, right, and has a hard time of it. Then we meet Jared, who is is now a California homeowner in the Bay Area, but had started out as a teenager as a very petty drug dealer, right? So Jared goes to school with LSD, decides to try and sell it, gets caught, and gets given a second chance. So that both let me study homeownership and taxation history in California, property taxes, and criminal justice. And then the last story, Barbara Katz, is a boomer age woman who's born into the upper middle class in Texas and falls out of it for a number of reasons I talk about in the book. And so she ends up in her 60s working at IHOP, and she doesn't have health insurance. They didn't expand Medicaid in Texas, which, you know, social science, very clear that that's because of racism. And she dies, right? She doesn't know she's diabetic. She goes into ketoacidosis at home and dies. And so that lets me both look at how much you could get from racism because she had one of the largest sort of total white bonus figures in the book, but also how much you can lose, right, when you let racism sort of ruin democracy and social provision.
I'd love to hear you talk a little bit more about that, because in the intro you write, any honest consideration of a white bonus, though, must also address a related element, racism's cost to all of us. And I wonder, can you just talk about that concept as it relates to your own experience and maybe read a little bit of the book to us?
Sure. So I think, you know, for me, like the work of Heather McGee was really important for framing this out, right? She writes about how, you know, racism sort of ruins all this stuff that we could have if we work together collectively. And, you know, Heather's focus is very much on policy, but I think it shows up in a lot of sort of more subtle ways as well. And so
one example I just wanted to bring in while we're doing this is that you talk about rent stabilization in New York, right? And it was an example of like racial cooperation being functional at a certain particular time, right? I just wanted to point that out, that I thought that was a good point that you made. I have nothing more.
Yeah, I mean, rent stabilization has been, I mean, transformational for me. You know, I would not be able to be a writer if I didn't have rent-regulated housing, right? If I wasn't protected from market forces. And that's only because both white people and people of color got over whatever anxieties they had about each other individually and build a movement that could demand that from politicians. And so I think, you know, for me, that's just really instructive, right? I think for a lot of white people, it can seem a little difficult to understand how this stuff would work in practice. And I'm just lucky, you know, that my life has been shaped in a way where I see it work in practice every day.
Okay, we're going to take a short break here and we'll be right back. And yet, you know, there are these examples of cooperation, but there is, again, the cost when we don't cooperate. And you write very eloquently about that cost in your own personal life in many instances in the book. But one that struck me in particular was when you were living in New York, I think it's after college, and you have a roommate who assaults you, in essence, when you're unconscious. And it takes you a while to figure out that an assault is what in fact happened. And you go to the police to talk about it, and they really aren't listening to you. I wondered if you could talk. I know it's difficult personal material, but it's there, and you're writing about this very charged personal material in the book, and I wondered if you could talk about including that and read us a section that comes right after that.
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. You know, it's always difficult, right, to write about sexual assault, but for me it felt so important to include because it's something so many women experience. And, you know, the more I worked on it in this book, the more that I understood just how deeply this experience had shaped what I expected of the world and my thoughts around sort of what people have to put up with and whether or not people are going to stand up for you, right? So I will read from this passage. Okay. For a long time, when I heard people talk about the privileges of white women, I remembered my assault and how I was dismissed by police, and I felt resentment stir up in me. What did being white get me? Nothing useful from the police, that is for certain. I did not understand that while I was white, I was also female and broke, facing off against a white man, albeit a relatively broke one as well. His whiteness would protect him from police action. Mine did little more than give me the false hope that I'd be taken seriously. This, it seems, is the way men with power have usually treated white women, as secondary to white men, a protection only of interest insofar as it justifies their violence against other men. This is how it was with lynching in the early 20th century. The common understanding among whites back then, especially those in the South, was that lynching was a justifiable response to black men raping white women. The rape of white women by black men was not common, but white journalists did little to dispel this notion. Some knowingly published stories that claimed to document rape of which there was no evidence. As the early 20th century investigative journalist Ida B. Wells showed in her reporting, only 1/3 of black men who were lynched had even been charged with rape, let alone convicted of it. Nor, argued Wells, was lynching an honest reflection of white men's desire to protect white women. The cowardly lyncher revels in murder, then seeks to shield himself from public execration by claiming devotion to woman, she wrote. Protecting white women was never really the point. Terrorizing black people was. This violence still echoes today. In the 1990s, feminists won inclusion of the Violence Against Women Act as part of President Clinton's 1994 crime bill. The act expanded the range of punishments for sexual assault and other gender crimes and increased the funding to prosecute those crimes. Some women called this a victory. Some scholars began to call this use of the state's criminal justice system to achieve arguably feminist goals, carceral feminism. Yet, these vast new punishments have done little to protect women from violence. In 2005, in consideration of a case where 3 girls were killed by their father, against whom their mother had a restraining order, the Supreme Court ruled that police have no constitutional obligation to protect any person from harm. Criminal justice data suggests that while sentences for sexual assault have nearly doubled in length since 1994, the likelihood of a sexual assault leading to conviction of a crime is minuscule. Victim advocates estimate that only 5% of sexual assaults even result in an arrest. Less than 3% of perpetrators are ever convicted. The most significant change achieved by criminalizing sexual assault has been to lengthen the time spent in jail by the tiny proportion of assailants who are caught, charged, and convicted. The most significant change, in other words, has been to increase the power of the state to incarcerate citizens for much of the rest of their lives. Where rape convictions in the early 1990s typically saw a 10-year sentence, they now result in sentences longer than 18 years. And as with so many things in American society, that power to punish hits hardest upon people who are not white. There are no contemporary numbers documenting the racial demographics of people convicted of sexual assault, but figures from the late 1990s offer a clue. From 1994 to 1998, criminal justice researchers estimated that 70% of sexual assailants were white, but only 60% of people charged with rape were. Meanwhile, Black men made up 18% of sexual assailants, but Black people constituted 38% of arrests for rape, so more than double. It is hard for me to look at this history and believe that either lynching or modern criminal justice have ever been about creating a society that is safer for anyone at all. To me, it looks like powerful people justifying their own abuses. First, vigilante violence by white men, and then mass incarceration by the state. In both cases, most white women bought into the idea that aligning themselves with those who promised protection, whether they needed it or not, whether it was delivered or not, would keep them safe. But white women are no safer because of lynching or mass incarceration. Not that those things would be justified if we were. The ugly lesson that silently watching oppression, even joining in on the oppression itself, is the only way we'll survive was always a lie. But it is a lie with which my country and I are familiar. It is the lie Grandma Kate told herself when she said I should stay in a home where I was abused. And it is the one Bonnie, my stepmother, echoes when she gaslights me. It is the lie my father believed when he attacked me that implied I'd never go to college if I complained. My family treats that ugly lesson like it is gospel and believes the lie like it is scripture. I do not think we are the only ones.
Thank you very much. You cite a number of authors during the book who influenced your writing and investigation. You've already mentioned Heather McGee. I wondered if you could talk about her work and the other writers that were helpful to you during this journey.
Yeah, I mean, I drew on a lot of different writers. You know, Heather McGee's work about the cost of racism to everyone, that was really important for me because I had been thinking that idea through, but I hadn't done, you know, she does so much work and research to build that case. And certainly The Sum of Us was really important for me, which came out after I had sold the proposal for this book. You know, in terms of the writing, I honestly paid a lot of attention to Kiese Layman's work and Jesmyn Ward's work, like in memoir. Both Heavy and Men We Reaped were really important to me because those were the first memoirs I read where there was some engagement with big structural force and how that can sort of overlay with abuse that's happening in a family, as well as maintaining love and affection for the adults, right, who are doing some abuse, right? And for me, that was really important. I'm trying to think who else. I mean, obviously, one of the touchstones in terms of scholarship was Ira Katznelson's When Affirmative Action Was White, right? I get asked about affirmative action a lot, and, you know, if I'm feeling punchy, I say, well, we've long had affirmative action for white people, right? So, you know, we should sort of be spinning that out. I mean, I'm trying to think what else. I mean, the bibliography is
well, you'll never get everyone. There are good notes in the book about these, so I would encourage readers to just go read it.
Right. And another. I got another.
The bibliography was really fun to read. I was like, yeah, I mean, to sort of think about what you were in conversation with was really fascinating. So the bibliography is not the only juicy thing at the end of the book. Tracy's book also will point you, listeners, to a URL where you can calculate your own white bonus. So I went to this URL and because I was curious. I was like, I mean, I clearly am someone who benefits. As an Asian American, I am benefiting from certain aspects of whiteness. I also have faced certain kinds of the discrimination that are outlined in the book. And so I was like, what I see, Tracy, is that you are still developing how this calculator is going to work. And I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about what that process is like, the actual math of it, and what we will find when it is done.
Yeah, so I am hoping to develop a white bonus estimator that would sort of work online. It's almost like a quiz right? And so something where you can sort of choose your level of engagement, something where, you know, you would have, you could do it in 2 or 3 minutes, it'll just spit out a bunch of median numbers, right, for you and give you some sense of stuff. Or be able to do something more engaged with, you know, you remember how much money you got for X, Y, or Z and figure that out, right? Because there's, you have to do a lot of sort of data points feeding in to build that. So I have, you know, a skeleton and an infrastructure for it for people that know how to build online things. But we're still, I'm still looking for support for that. I think, you know, this, I think this is a really important conversation for us to have because I don't think we can solve racism until we're honest about it in this country. And being honest about it means being honest that like there's a bonus that for white people that's part of this, right? But it's been more difficult than I expected to get some of the bigger sort of newsrooms on board with like thinking about this and engaging with it, right? So like we're still working to place op-eds and things like that and sort of see who wants to have this conversation because there's such an anxiety over, you know, well, we can't quantify this or measure this and how would you do that?
So are you looking for like programmers? You're looking for, I was told there would be no math, so I can't help you with any math. what are you looking for?
I'll take all comers. I mean, I need somebody who knows how to code and program and then can host it, right? Like this isn't something that should just be on my personal website, I don't think, right? Like I don't have capacity for that. So, you know, we'll see how the book does as it goes out into the world. And then if we can get enough folks on board to have this conversation, I'm optimistic, right, that I'll be able to build something online.
Well, listeners, be on the lookout for whitebonus.com, I think is the URL that you have saved for this. and we hope to be able to go there and do this math for ourselves so that we can hold ourselves accountable and be part of this conversation. Tracy, thank you so much for joining us. And listeners, don't miss the book, which is available now in an independent bookstore near you.
Thank you so much. This was really awesome, you guys.
That's it for the Fiction Nonfiction Podcast. This podcast is produced by Anne Kniggendorf. Our theme music is composed by Travis Workman. You can subscribe to us by typing fiction/non/fiction into the search bar of your favorite podcast app. Please go give us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts if you haven't done it yet. You can also listen, find previous episodes, and read excerpts from our interviews at the Literary Hub website, lithub.com, where the Fiction Nonfiction Podcast page is listed under the Lit Hub Radio tab. We'll also post that show page with links to the books we referenced this week on Facebook at FNF Pod, on Twitter at FNF Talk, on Instagram at fiction.non.fiction.podcast. You can find video of our interviews at our own Fiction Nonfiction Podcast YouTube channel and IGTV channel and on our website at fnfpodcast.net, where our back episodes are grouped by topic areas. Happy reading!